Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. U.S. scientists are accelerating tests on a possible cure for Ebola. However, it is more complicated than one might imagine.
We've had experience with vaccines that you actually think they're going to prevent infection and they make things worse.
Carol Pearson pays us a visit in the cafe with the story. From Los Angeles, Elizabeth Lee reports that for would-be journalists, things have changed.
I think we're entering a market now where if you don't have kind of a wide range of skills and have a little bit of knowledge of everything, you're probably going to have a difficult time finding a job.
And George Putich checks in with what is happening to the Florida orange crop. It is under attack.
It's something I think about every day. I think about it at night when I'm supposed to be sleeping. It's a huge problem, and we need to come up with as many tools as we can.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. A U.S. health agency is speeding up clinical trials of a possible vaccine against the deadly Ebola virus that has so far killed more than 1,500 people in West Africa. VOA's Carol Pearson spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci, an infectious disease expert who is overseeing the trials.
Researchers have found a vaccine against Ebola that protects monkeys from the deadly virus. It's slated for human trials early because of the dire situation in West Africa. Scientists need to find out what it does when given to people. At the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Anthony Fauci will oversee the trials.
So you want to balance the need to get a potentially effective vaccine to the people who need it as quickly as possible, at the same time that you structure it in a way that you can get some meaningful information as to A, whether it does work or not, and whether it does harm.
Dr. Fauci says proving safety is critical.
We've had experience with vaccines that you actually think they're going to prevent infection and they make things worse.
If it goes well, the next step is a larger trial in the countries where the outbreak is occurring. But this also has to be done scientifically. Those who get the vaccine have to be monitored. Dr. Fauci says vaccine trials are very different from providing experimental drugs to treat Ebola.
It's not like a drug in which you're giving to a very sick person who has no other option. A vaccine is given to a healthy person. So the idea of first do no harm is much, much more compelling when you're dealing with someone who is a normal, healthy person versus someone who is desperately ill and has no form of therapy but needs something. Those are two very different scenarios.
One of the biggest concerns is the lack of infrastructure in the countries where the outbreak is raging. Too few doctors, too little protective gear, not enough treatment centers or medicines to help sick patients. The World Health Organization is asking for $500 million to address these issues. If a larger trial is warranted, it will start early next year. Dr. Fauci says he hopes the situation in West Africa will be better under control by then. Still, he says, even if the vaccine is effective, it's not the answer to the current outbreak.
We have an ongoing epidemic. We do not have a vaccine, so that's a hypothetical. We do not have drugs, so that's a hypothetical. Right now, what we do have is the possibility of infection control, isolation, quarantine and contact tracing. That is what is going to bring this epidemic under control.
Health officials say precaution and prevention remain the best defenses against the disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
The internet and rapidly evolving technology is quickly changing how people receive news and how journalists cover it. There are now more ways to tell a story than ever before. One school in Los Angeles is teaching the next generation of journalists with the help of a state-of-the-art newsroom. Elizabeth Lee has this report.
You learn how to tell a story well, and maybe that's your area of expertise.
When Faith Miller wanted to study journalism in college, she never expected this.
We begin with breaking news.
I did not expect that in school I would be reporting on real stories, and I did not know how much work goes into it.
Unlike their counterparts of past generations, students at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Journalism learn to deliver news across all platforms, including television, radio, and the web. And that's not all, says Willow Bay, director of the School of Journalism.
But today, we expect journalists to be able to use all sorts of technological tools to research stories, to vet that research, to analyze that research. We expect them to be fluid in multimedia storytelling skills. We expect them increasingly to be their own marketing and distribution arms, to get their stories in front of audiences and to spread those stories as far as they can.
They learn all that in this brand new media center, the newsroom of the future, where student journalists who work on TV, radio, and the web sit side by side and collaborate. They also have to be tech savvy, and that means learning basic computer programming languages.
They need to know how the web works and be able to tinker with it.
Digital journalism professor Robert Hernandez demonstrates some of the cutting-edge web tools reporters can use to tell stories in a different way.
You can do 360 panorama through your phone, right? We can talk about what a tornado looks like, how it rips trees out of the ground. Through their phone, there's an app to kind of stitch that together.
Take a picture.
Students can also take a class that experiments with Google Glass, a device that connects to the internet and records video and audio. Will Fetterman is a print and digital journalism student.
I think we're entering a market now where if you don't have kind of a wide range of skills and have a little bit of knowledge of everything, you're probably going to have a difficult time finding a job.
The goal is not just to prepare students for the real world, but to also make them technologically savvy, so as technology evolves, they can also adapt quickly. But with new technology, future journalists should tread carefully, says the Media Center's executive director, Serena Cha.
In the journalism arena, we've got to consider carefully, how do we teach students to use the tools responsibly? So, yes, new technology often raises new questions because you're able to manipulate reality even more than before.
Faculty members say at the core of all this technology, students still need to learn traditional journalism, how to write and tell a compelling story in a way that is accurate, fair, and balanced. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Florida's citrus fruit industry is facing a serious threat from a bacteria carried by the Asian insect called Celid. The widespread infestation again highlights the danger of transferring non-native species to American soil. VOA's George Putich reports.
Citrus ranchers in Florida are burning orange trees damaged by a spotted brown bug called Celid. It is a native of Asia and carries what the Chinese call the yellow dragon disease. Florida ranchers call it greening. While feeding on citrus leaves, the bug infests them with bacteria that clog the tree's capillary system, slowly choking it to death. The fruit borne by the diseased plant is small. It falls off, and the tree eventually dies. No citrus-growing countries have developed a cure. Farmer Alice Hunt is extremely frustrated.
When you spend the money to raise it and get it almost there and it turns loose and hits the ground, that's a disaster. That's heartbreaking.
To make matters worse, Florida's $9 billion citrus growing industry, second only to Brazil, is fighting growing foreign competition and declining sales due to the U.S. consumers' growing aversion to sugar and carbohydrates. The industry's 75,000 jobs depend on finding a cure to the disease. At the University of Florida's Citrus Research and Education Center, some of the world's best botanists and entomologists are trying to save the existing trees, grow new ones resistant to the bacterium, and make the insect incapable of transmitting the disease. Entomologist Kristen Pelz-Stelinski says the problem is keeping her awake at night.
It's something I think about every day. I think about it at night when I'm supposed to be sleeping. It's a huge problem, and we need to come up with as many tools as we can.
Pels Stelinski says it may take as long as 5 years to come up with a way to make the psyllid bug free of the dangerous bacteria. In the meantime, botanists are experimenting with grafting as a way to keep the existing trees alive, while citrus farmers try to control the disease by spraying the trees and feeding them with nutrients, added expenses that further shrink their income. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Immigration activists in New York are calling on President Barack Obama to unilaterally end deportations and allow undocumented immigrants to work legally by the end of the summer. Daniela Schreier reports from a New York rally where activists demanded that the president immediately institute what is known as administrative relief for the immigrants, a move strongly opposed by conservatives.
Undocumented mothers literally stood up for their rights, calling on President Obama to keep his promise for executive action on immigration reform and keep their families safe. The people at this informal public meeting, known as a town hall, want President Obama to use his power as president, called executive authority, to enact reforms without Congress, as he promised in a late August speech.
I've been very clear about the fact that our immigration system is broken and needs to be fixed. But have no doubt, in the absence of congressional action, I'm going to do what I can to make sure the system works better.
Legislation to reform immigration procedures has been tied up in Congress, and some conservative House Republicans have threatened to withhold funding to the U.S. government if the president pushes ahead unilaterally. Betsy Plum with New York Immigration Coalition.
President Obama has come out. He came out on June 30th. He said, if Congress cannot act, if they continue to allow such a broken system that does more harm than good, then he will act. And that's completely within his executive power.
The town hall brought together immigration activists, undocumented immigrants, and politicians, all calling for an immediate end to deportations and a pathway to citizenship. Social media plays a huge role in mobilizing the community. The hashtag #AllInForRelief is used by the activists to gather support online for administrative action. But President Obama himself has said his executive powers will have limits.
Even with aggressive steps on my part, administrative action alone will not adequately address the problem. The reforms that will do the most to strengthen our businesses, our workers, and our entire economy will still require an act of Congress.
Congressional action, says Project 21's Horace Cooper, is the only way to solve the current immigration dilemma.
The right answer is for the White House and the Congress to come together and work collaboratively to develop a solution to the issues involving immigration. That's what the American people expect, and that's the normal way to proceed, and it will minimize the likelihood of significant political blowback, litigation, or other kinds of concerns.
At the town hall, co-host Linda Sarsour rallied the crowd to keep fighting for more substantive and broader reform.
We will not stop fighting till every single undocumented immigrant in this country has a pathway to citizenship and they become voting citizens of this country. You ready to stay fighting? You ready to stay fighting?
The event closed on a celebratory note, with many hopeful that the president would soon enact policies to protect undocumented immigrant families, despite staunch resistance from conservatives. Daniela Schreier, VOA News, New York.
When the Nazi army moved into the Polish city of Łódź in 1939, it marked the beginning of a long nightmare for the Jewish community that once made up one-third of the population. Roughly 200,000 people were forced into the Łódź ghetto. Less than 7,000 survived. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, some survivors gathered in Chicago on the 70th anniversary of the liquidation of the Łódź ghetto to remember those who suffered at the hands of the Nazi regime.
From a window above a main street of Łódź, Ella Rosenblatt-Chatowski had a prime view of the Polish city of 700,000 people and fondly remembers life in the vibrant pre-World War II Jewish community.
It was a big city. It was a happy. I didn't feel any difference. I was young and I was enjoying myself.
That all changed in September of 1939 when the Nazi army invaded Poland and occupied Łódź.
I was on a Friday at 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. The German army start to come in with the tanks, with the motorcycles. I was not smart enough to be scared or not.
Ella's future husband, Leon Chytowski, quickly learned the brutal reality of life under the Nazi regime, which transformed the area around his home in Łódź into the second largest Jewish ghetto in Europe.
They started to take people to work, people to slaughter, to beat them.
And I watched with my own eyes how the German SS threw literally little children from 2-3 floors to speed up the selection. They hauled all those people behind the town and lodge, and those elderly and those sick, I don't know how they did, they had to dig graves, and they shot them and buried them all there.
This 1942 mass killing was just one of numerous atrocities Charles Lipschitz recalls that was visited upon the Jewish community of Łódź during a five-year period that ended in August of 1944 when the Nazis liquidated the ghetto. Many were sent to the infamous Auschwitz-Birkenau camp, where they were murdered in gas chambers. Leon Chytowski is the only one of his family of nine who survived the Holocaust. The numerical tattoo on his arm, put there by the Nazis, is a constant reminder of the ordeal.
This is the legacy what we're leaving.
For his wife, Ella, all that remains to remember her family are a few pictures she salvaged from the ghetto's garbage piles at the end of the war.
Oh, sure, I remember. I got the pictures. So I always, every night, I'm just looking and thinking about it. But that's what it is. It's a long time.
This is my grandfather.
When the war began, Charles Lipschitz had an extended family of about 200 people living in Łódź. By the end of the war, only three were left: Charles, his brother, and a cousin. Lipschitz and fellow survivors paid tribute at a ceremony honoring the memory of those who perished in one of the worst atrocities in history. He says he is often asked about seeking vengeance on those who made his family and his community suffer.
My vengeance is what me and my wife built. We built a beautiful family with children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren.
It is the family Charles Lipschitz, and many like him who survived, rebuilt from the ashes of war. A war and a Holocaust he hopes stays in the past, but is never forgotten. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
The United States has a full-time military, and it also has a part-time military called the National Guard. The Guard was recently in the news when the governor of the state of Missouri called on it to assist state and local police as protests erupted after the August killing of an unarmed African-American by a white police officer. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti explains the difference between the National Guard and the U.S. military through this visit to a National Guard base in Pennsylvania. First, we want to warn you that the first sounds may be alarming, but that it's not a real disaster.
Ow! Ow!
The moans start slowly, echoing from a green field surrounded by the Appalachian Mountains of Pennsylvania. Soon, it becomes a sad song, the harmonizing suffering of victims lying in the grass with deep gashes in their thighs or on their arms. A man reaches out to grab the pant leg of a rescuer, a medic in a protective white suit.
Hurry, please.
It may sound awful, except none of this is real. There was no tornado that destroyed the building where these victims worked. There was no radiation leak to force medics into protective suits. The victims are actors. The medics are members of the Pennsylvania National Guard training for the worst.
This is about replicating. It's about as bad as it could possibly be.
That's General Wesley Craig, the head of the Pennsylvania Guard.
What are we going to do? This.
Staff Sergeant Ernest Hilbert is giving orders as the medics are sprayed down to remove any chemical residue.
Hilbert's full-time job is cleaning a veteran's homeless shelter.
Most of the time, you may see me mopping, sweeping, and talking with the residents.
Disconnect your home.
But for 2 weeks every summer and 1 weekend every month, he becomes a warrior.
Press that button right there and you just disconnect.
Hilbert has been a corrections officer in Iraq and has protected a flooded Pennsylvania town from looters.
The public doesn't have to worry. We're here.
The National Guard is often activated to assist the U.S. military overseas, like in Iraq and Afghanistan. But most of the time, its members are citizens protecting other citizens after natural or man-made disasters. There are 460,000 so-called citizen soldiers across the United States. Every state has its own National Guard. Just recently, the Missouri governor called his troops into action. Ferguson, Missouri erupted in violence on August 9th when a white police officer killed an unarmed black teenager after a confrontation on the street. The Missouri Guard worked 4 days, backing up state and local police who were monitoring the numerous protests. Stephen Bucci served many years in the Army's Special Forces and then worked with the National Guard as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense.
Every time there's a civil disturbance in one of our towns or cities, you don't automatically see the National Guard rushing in to deal with it, because the vast majority of time the local police are equipped and capable and have the relationship with the communities to defuse the situation.
The Missouri governor credited the Guard for protecting the command center, allowing police time to restore trust with the community. Had the violence escalated, the Missouri governor could have declared martial law. But Bucci says that could have escalated an already tense situation.
Another chaotic night.
Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Fort Indian Town Gap Training Base in Pennsylvania.
People with cognitive problems, including memory loss due to Alzheimer's disease, may someday be able to have their memory boosted with electric current. Researchers used a non-invasive procedure called transcranial magnetic stimulation to jumpstart a region of the brain that's involved in forming memories. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
Known as TMS, the technique uses a mild electrical current through the skull to strengthen communication among brain cells involved in memory. It could lead to new treatments for memory impairments caused by trauma, illness, or aging. Current therapies such as surgery and drugs have not proven effective. The neurons targeted by transcranial magnetic stimulation are part of a pathway to the hippocampus, a deep brain region that's involved in the formation of memories. Neuroscientist Joel Voss of Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Illinois explains that the stimulation is painless and non-invasive.
What the TMS coil does is it produces a volley of pulses of the stimulation. And so it sounds like a high-frequency tapping sound, like a da-da-da-da-da-da-da tapping sound with about 20 clicks per second. And those clicks are aimed at the back part of the person's head, over the parietal cortex. And it really feels like each one of them feels like a very slight kind of tapping sensation on the outside of the head.
In a study involving 16 healthy adults ages 21 to 40, researchers took detailed anatomical pictures of the brain using MRI. The imaging mapped each participant's neural network. Writing in the journal Science, Voss says his team found the individual's memories had improved after TMS, and the MRI showed the memory neurons became more synchronized with each other and the hippocampus. The next step is to try to boost the memories of older adults and those with mild cognitive impairment using transcranial magnetic stimulation. But he says healthy people should not try to boost their memories with TMS since it's still experimental. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
That is all the time we have for this week's show. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com. Email us at americancafe@voanews.com. Give us a telephone call. Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your questions or your comments. For all of the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll talk to you next time on American Cafe.